Welcome to Shooks and Gifts, Season 7, Episode 3. In this episode, I sit down with Tom Mullaney to discuss his just-released blog post called Pedagogy and the AI Chatbot, or What Teachers Should Know About the Eliza Effect. If you don't know what this is, and you're feeling any apprehensions, or really you're diving right into AI, this conversation is worth a listen. Let's give it a go. Welcome to Shooks and GIF, the podcast where I share edtech treasures I love. Each episode, I share a tool, website, tip, trick, or more that you might find helpful for you or your learners. I'm your host, Jen Giffen. Let's give it a go. If someone could let the makers of avocados know to put a different toy inside, I'd really appreciate it. I have like 50 wooden balls already. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 3 of Shooks and GIF. I am joined today by Tom Mullaney, and we are going to talk about AI, but not in the usual lens that I have been sharing it. Tom reached out to me after the last episode and sort of talked to the fact that I said I had trepidation. I was feeling like I wasn't being really creative, or I was losing my creativity by using AI so much. And he said he was feeling some similar thoughts and had some really big feels that he wouldn't mind sharing and talking about if I was game for it. And I said, absolutely. Now, I did have some audio issues. It's why Tom is not here in this intro part. It was really glitchy at the beginning, and you'll notice there's some blips throughout. I do apologize for that. But know that Tom was an educator for 12 years. He's now a consultant. His specialty is history and special ed. He brings in a wealth of knowledge. I really enjoy speaking with him. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. It takes us on a different route than I have been taking with discussing AI, and I hope you find it enlightening and it gives you some ahas. So we're going to dive right into the conversation without further ado. Here it is.
Expressing any reservations about AI in education, I feel like I'm openly supporting communism in the 1950s. There's backlash.
Yeah.
What started our conversation was when I was listening to your podcast episode, you said, quote, "I find the more I use AI, the less creative I'm being, and I don't think as quickly." And that just spoke to me. That spoke to a lot of how I'm feeling about this and creativity, because we always are talking about creativity, creativity, creativity. And then we're saying, have this autocomplete do your first draft. You know, that just doesn't feel congruous to me. I think what we'll talk about today is a bit of a separate conversation about AI, but that's what got us talking, was about the whole AI and creativity thing.
Tom, where do you want to start with today? What is it that you think is the most resonating thing you want to share with people about how you're feeling, that they might also be feeling, or to give pause to? Before we started recording, I talked about, you know, maybe they're getting on a sled. Like, I'm going to go with my snow analogy because, you know, we might go sledding later today. And you start going down the hill and you're like, okay, this is fun. And all of a sudden the hill's a lot steeper than you think. And you're just going so quickly that there's no way to get back. Right. And there's the fear, maybe, or there's that we've gone so far with kids. You can't, you know, what do they say? You can't put it back in the bottle, so to speak.
Okay. So I recently saw an instructional strategy with AI that I saw shared, and I'm actually doing a blog post about this at my website, tommullaney.com. It might be posted by the time this airs. It might not be. I don't know, but we'll see. Anyway, the idea is the AI guest speaker. And so in a live classroom setting, the class is seated, the teacher's in front, and the students create questions that in real time live, the teacher types into either ChatGPT or Google Gemini, used to be called Bard, or another large language model AI chatbot. We'll call it AI chatbots. And so the big thing, my biggest pedagogical concern, is something called the Eliza effect. Let's take the Eliza effect and put a pin in it for a second. I'm going to first just talk about talking to the dead. I was a history teacher, right? So as a history teacher, you might say, oh, let's interview George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. Both of those individuals, and plenty more from American history, enslaved human beings. So let's just not do that. I just want to say, not a pedagogical issue, just an appropriateness issue, just a how would people in our, you know, in students in marginalized groups feel about that? You know, we're just not going to do that. So that's one.
Right. Akin here in Canada, if we looked at Sir John A. Macdonald, who was the first Prime Minister of Canada, who had a hand in establishing residential schools for Indigenous peoples, same sort of thing. Like we definitely have a congruent people in Canadian history as well. And I'm sure globally, other listeners from around the world are going to find the
Both
same thing.
Both the United States and Canada were founded on imperialist colonialism. And so you need to respect that and not trivialize it. So let's talk about some other possible AI guest speakers. So you have like, you know, Harriet Tubman, Anne Frank, Martin Luther King, Shirley Chisholm. So again, well, one with Harriet Tubman, what she went through, it just feels very trivializing to say, all right, she's an AI guest speaker. With Anne Frank, we have the diary of Anne Frank. Let's just go with that. Having said that, mm-hmm. you know, what about a Martin Luther King? What about a Shirley Chisholm, first Black woman to run for president in 1972? Well, let's think about the AI industry, right? It's dominated. There's a great New York Times piece about that. The backers of it are mostly white. They're exclusively male. OpenAI's executive board is entirely white and male. One of them is a man named Lawrence Summers, who's most famous. He was a Treasury Secretary in the United States at one point. He was a president of Harvard. But what he's most famous for is saying that men have more aptitude for science than women. So if you're encouraging women to get into STEM and you're excited to use ChatGPT, just understand there's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Some dissonance.
Yes, some dissonance. Now, having said, and by, oh, one other thing about that. Recently, I don't think it was OpenAI or Google, but there were people who used AI to give literal voice, not chatbot voice, but actual recreate the voices of comedians George Carlin
and Robin Williams. Yeah, I heard this.
Both cases. The families, I think, have sued.
Rightfully so, because they're putting words into people's mouths for things that those people didn't say. So we have the Robin Williams, we have the George Carlin. They're not here to defend, like, hey, I wouldn't say that. Particularly Carlin, because he had some pretty on the margin opinions at times, right? We listen to a lot of Carlin. It's one of my husband's absolute favorite comedians. So they're saying things potentially that could go down. Again, if we're going to believe, I think we've talked about this. We're going to, yeah, we put it in front of you, and this is the Eliza effect, and maybe you want to. I don't know if I'm heading there too quickly for you, but we're going to believe what they say automatically. So, oh, well, yeah, of course they would have said that, because this sounds like it could be them, because all the words around it sound like them, and we can say whatever we want for them.
Right. So let's talk about different proposed AI speakers. You know, could you have an animal, a job, an object, a concept such as the water cycle? That's the AI guest speaker. And so all those concerns I talked about, the dead, don't apply. So now, hey, I'm going to have the water cycle, and ChatGPT is going to be the water cycle. Okay, no issues. Let's talk about the Eliza effect.
Can I, before you do that, are you okay with, let's say I'm looking behind you, you have a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. What are your thoughts on if I say interview someone who helped build the Golden Gate Bridge? Like, so a nondescript person other than their job, not an actual influential person, can't put a name or face on it, but to represent a collective. How are your feelings on that?
I would say let's throw that in the bucket of animal water effect, of water cycle. It's just that that's fine. Let's just go with that. All right. That's fine.
You're more concerned about the specific historical people.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So construction work on the Golden Gate Bridge. Fine. We'll do that. That's fine. So Eliza effect. There's a computer scientist named Joseph Weizenbaum. In the 1960s, he creates a chatbot that's a therapist chatbot who he names Eliza after Eliza Doolittle from Pygmalion. He's observing people interact with the chatbot. And there's a great article, and I'll link it in my blog post in The Guardian. It's a deep, long-form profile of Joseph Weizenbaum and his Eliza and the Eliza effect. Every teacher should read it. And he noticed that people were believing that the computer knew them and was human. And so he didn't coin the term Eliza effect. Later researchers did. But the Eliza effect is just the idea that people tend to project human characteristics onto computers that generate text. And so one of the things he noticed was that people who would interact with Eliza would give to it powers of judgment and think it was deserving of credibility. So as humans are interacting with chatbots, they're thinking they're human and they're thinking they have credibility. I found a quote. It's actually quoted in the Guardian piece from Colin Fraser. He's a data scientist in Meta. Says the technology chatbots is designed to trick you, to make you think you're talking to someone who's not actually there. Just think about that for a second, and then think about using that technology designed to trick you with children. Mm-hmm. Pause. You know, like that's okay. Let's pause. Now, having established that, we have a little problem. At the same time, as far as accuracy, you know, if I'm interviewing the water cycle, if the chatbots are accurate, it's a little bit of a problem because of how the students might perceive the chatbot, but it's not a problem for inaccuracy. But there is a lot of data out there that says that chatbots inherently have inaccuracy and bias. I'll give you one. There's a startup called Vectera, as former Google employees, and they said, even in situations designed to prevent this from happening, chatbots invent information at least 3% of the time, as high as 27%. Now, I was a social studies teacher, and I'm sure looking back on the curricular materials I provided my students, there were errors in there. And of course, there's bias. There's always bias, but honestly, there might have been historically oppressive bias in there too. In fact, there probably was. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Having said that, if someone handed me something to give to students as a curricular resource, and they said, "Hey, just so you know, 3% of this is inaccurate," nope, not going to do it. So just something to think. We know there's bias and inaccuracy, and we know that there's a tendency of all people to intuit trust, judgment, credibility, human characteristics. That's a really troubling thing for me pedagogically. Yeah.
Do you think too, then, when we go back to this idea of the water cycle, because anything that LLM produces like would be more factual, whereas when we're talking about people's responses are generally going to be subjective, emotional, biased in general. Like, we don't know what they were thinking. We know how the water cycle works. It's a proven scientific fact. Whereas while we can look at people's diaries and people's speeches and actions that happened throughout their lifetime, we're still making a lot of assumptions around who they were and what they thought. Is that essentially what you're saying too?
Well, here's the thing. So I have a quote from Adi Galati. All right. She's a Google research product manager. And mm-hmm. she said, quote, "It's important to understand that Bard," and now Bard is Gemini, right, "is not intended to be a tool that provides specific or factual answers. For that purpose, Google is the best tool." The idea that an LLM is meant to answer your questions on a factual basis, right? I have another good one from a robotics researcher. His name's Rodney Brooks. What large language models are good at is saying what an answer should look like, which is different from what an answer should be, right? And that makes sense because it's literally just predicting the next text. It's not going into its brain and saying, "Oh, okay, yeah, I know that condensation." You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's what if you're using an LLM as, "Let me look up whether or not this is fact." That's not what LLMs are designed for, and so that for the guest speaker. It already from a guest speaker that tells us that's a bit problematic because a guest speaker should know the facts. But when you combine that with the student's tendency, as documented by the Eliza effect, to believe it or think it's right or think it's human, then we get into real problems.
This is very interesting because I find myself more and more going to, not more and more, but I have more frequently in the last, let's say, 4 to 6 weeks, rather than Google something, I'm like, "Oh, I'll just throw in ChatGPT for basic facts, like my first hit might be on Wikipedia." And this is part of the reason, Tom, I wanted to have you on. I don't know that I even gave pause to think about that yet. It what LLM does and all of our chatbots is, like you said, predicting the next word, not necessarily looking for facts. Also, the synthesis of looking from resource to resource to decide, okay, what can I rely on? What makes sense to me works better in Google than it would in ChatGPT. Although I will say I found something recently and I said, "Can you explain this to me?" Like, I was in the sixth grade and it helped me with that. But it was because I had some understanding from what I Googled. Wasn't understanding. It was very, I don't even remember what it was. It was something very scientific. It was some, a friend of mine had this like really bizarro virus. Like she was attacked out of nowhere, thought she was dying. It was really scary. And then she said, oh, it's this. And I read it and I'm like, oh, is this like a Listeria infection? And so then I went and I was trying to read between the two of them. And I'm like, this is so beyond. So I went to ChatGPT and I said, can you explain as a sixth grader both of these? And then I went back to my original source so that I had a better understanding. Like I didn't have the prior knowledge to latch on to for what I was reading. And then with this sixth grade version from ChatGPT, So I went back to the original. So this will give me pause. Okay, continue. Next thing. Keep telling me.
So, and actually it's not in my blog post, but the idea that a large language model is a search engine is so... it's two separate things. And even large language models don't have recent data as it is. So the most,
yes.
I actually once heard our speaker say, you can ask an LLM what the best Chrome extensions for education are. And I was like, but then I'd be getting 2 years old data. Like I get the,
unless you're in the paid version, right? Even because the paid version is, well, not, it's not as far back.
Okay.
But yes.
Having said that, I actually just pulled this up. You can Google this in the MIT Technology Review. So not, this is not like InfoWars. This is a legit source. App could one day replace search engines. Here's why that's a terrible idea. The sub lead on that is language models are mindless mimics that do not understand what they are saying. So why do we pretend they're experts? Do not use LLMs as a search engine. It's just not, it's not appropriate. It's two separate things, completely separate.
Okay. I like that. I like that because, yeah, I have, full disclosure, I've started being like, oh, well, it might be faster to get this because it's synthesized and I don't have to look through a ton.
I've also heard people say, well, we can verify what the ChatGPT is saying by using Google search, to which I would say, why not just use Google search, right? We're creating things for these chatbots to do that don't need to be done. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like that, and again, this is a bit of a separate issue from pedagogy and the AI guest speaker and the Eliza effect, but that's just, we're making work for these things that doesn't need to be done. Anyway, Jen, so that's just a little thing about search engines.
I love this, Tom. You have given me pause. So can I ask, when do you think, do you think there's a place for AI in education?
Okay, well, that's a much broader thing. I'll say a few things. So I have a friend, he works at a academic publishing review, and he takes abstracts that authors send him, then when authors are not native English speakers. And so he just uses ChatGPT to reword them. So he's just kind of cleaning up the grammar a little bit. And I do see from a writing perspective, let me be very clear about this, 10 years of special education. If you have a student who has a writing task and writing is a genuine struggle for them, and they just have to complete this task to open whatever the next door in their life is, I can see using it. I can totally see that.
Are you talking about like I have to write a paragraph about something, I put down my 0.4 main ideas, and it strings it together grammatically to make it sound, say, use as many of these words as possible, that kind of thing. I'm thinking my own son who has an IEP, right?
I can absolutely see that. Having said that, okay, when we talk about creativity, like I'm creating something that I want people to consider and read, a first draft is that I just don't think that's appropriate. Like I did this blog post. I did not ask, I could have gone to ChatGPT and said, ChatGPT, write me a blog post, and that I would say that's not information. Remember we talked about information earlier? Information has intent. That's not information.
I would be curious for you to do that though. I think you should do that and link it in your blog post and see what happens.
The amount of energy, I think I saw, and again, go to Google to verify this. I think I saw something the other day. Every ChatGPT prompt uses enough energy to charge your cell phone.
What?
So I personally, I'm just like, is this worth enough energy, enough resources on this very resource limited planet to do this?
I literally just leaned back in my chair with my hands on my head. I've not heard that.
So this could be a completely separate episode about the electricity, the data centers, and the water that is currently being used to power all this stuff. So the environmental impacts, and of course the bias even before inaccuracy, amplification of historic oppressive bias is the number one concern for me by far. Okay. But, and then also the copyright stuff, the stealing from artists, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Just sometimes I see presentations about AI where that's one slide. And these are like meant to be like intro to AI or overview of AI. And I'm, so I apologize. I'm getting a little negative here. I don't want to be like Debbie Downer raining on the parade. I'm just seeing a lot of the stuff that I see and that I read, I just don't see in the conversation, in the discourse. How can we say so?
Okay. You've said that you see it to help special ed students, AI, any other places that that it could be used? Like I'm thinking for me, based on our conversation now, and I'm every time I go to use AI now, Tom, I think I'm gonna hear you in my head saying like the water, because I'm huge on conservation of water. What about doing things like, oh, I'm aggregating data. I have all these data points. We did a school survey. I put all the answers in and I ask it to come up with the most common themes. Can you tell me the 10 things that are repeated here? Good use, bad use? Maybe we'll do this rapid fire.
Fine. I think that's fine. Like,
okay. Spreadsheets, creating a formula, any coding of that to streamline or to help us, like getting that code, that computer, what the computers are meant to do to help us. I'm thinking once I had a Google Sheet and I had all these students on it and all their schools, and I needed to come up, I knew Google Sheets could do it, come up with the formula to create the school email address from the school name, and then say, okay, here's the school and here's all of the kids with their student number, as I sent an email to the school to say, hey, they're attending this big district thing. So that took me 10 minutes to do instead of 2 hours to try to figure out.
Can I ask, did you enter student names and student ID numbers into like a ChatGPT?
No, I put fake student names and fake student numbers. I said here, and fake schools. And I said, okay, here's what I have. And then I was able to get the formula, because what I loved about ChatGPT is it says, okay, here's the parts of the formula and how you apply it. And then I was able to go into my secure data in Sheets and put it there. I did not put any student data. That I would know that, please, folks, if you're doing that to try it and be like, oh, it's safe. It is not safe. Do not put student data there. Do not do that.
No, it's not. No, never do that. That seems fine. It doesn't seem like it's a huge ethical, I don't know. It doesn't seem all that concerning.
Okay. What about I have students learning about the writing process, and I create mentor texts and have them critique what ChatGPT has created and compare it to the success criteria I have for the assignment.
So a couple things. If your kids see ChatGPT generating it, Eliza effect.
What about if I do it and don't tell them it's ChatGPT? Because we're doing that. Don't kid yourself, listeners. We are doing this. Like, oh, let's just create these examples and throw them out there.
So what I would say about that is you should read whatever ChatGPT produces with a fine tooth comb. One of the things I talk about in the blog post, we haven't talked about it yet. Just if you ever use Common Sense Media, go to their evaluations of ChatGPT and of Bard. They still call it Bard, you know, now it's Gemini. Some of the things it says in there, ChatGPT's false information can shape our worldview. Outside of education, the conversation is all about the downsides. It's just kind of funny how, for whatever reason, and again, I apologize for raining on a parade. I'm just trying to think critically about this stuff.
No, I don't think you need to apologize, and I don't think you're raining on a parade. I think that when we are at the infancy of any tools, and we're still there, we're only, for me, it was December the 7th, 2022, that I first used ChatGPT. I remember exactly where I was. My colleague Gary came and said, Jen, have you seen this thing? And I'm like, I kind of heard about it. He's like, you got to go try it out. And I was just like, I'm going to remember this date, and I do, forever. This is game changing. So I think we're still there, right? We're still looking at, we're a year and a bit, a year and a half beyond. If it was a child, it's still like a baby. I think we do need to be critical. I do think we need to examine all sides, particularly when we're entrusted with our most vulnerable, right? Children are in front of us. We are modeling. We we're setting that example. We are building habits, especially if we're teaching younger students. And even I would argue me as a high school teacher, they're very, I remember the first time I showed a student too, he sat beside me on this, we had this couch and this huge TV and I was playing with it on it. And he's like, what is this? And he looked at me, he goes, I'm never going to write another essay. And I sort of laughed and I said, let's talk about that. And we had this big, long philosophical discussion around it. And I realized that with anything we do in education, like I've been teaching 23 years for crying out loud, we really do make an impact. So if we're not having these critical conversations, if we're not doing a lot of really deep introspection, and the educators, you know, who are presenting these ideas, I can imagine who some of them are. I've seen a few out there who are talking about this. I think everyone's getting excited about it. And I think maybe in the background, we're having this moments of pause, but I do think we need to bring those moments of pause into the foreground as well, so that we don't get caught up in the flashing lights and the fancy, this is easy and this is fun and new.
So a couple things. One, I'm going to push about on something you said. Yeah. You said it's game changing. And I've heard other people say it's going to revolutionize education. That's an assumption. That's not a fact. That might happen. That might not happen.
Okay.
I tend to think it won't happen. I don't see, there's often things that we're told are revolutionized education and they really don't. So that's just an assumption. That's hype. That's not like, you don't have to accept that that's the truth. You should investigate that. You should like really critically think about that.
Right.
And then the other thing I'll say is, you know me, I'm a very tech forward person. You know, I love the Google Suite, or I, you know, that's what got me mm-hmm. into this. I've partnered with Figma because I love FigJam. Like I could play with, and people at Figma might be listening to this now and they're reconsidering those partnerships, but whatever.
I hope they're not. I hope nobody does. Like, you know, you talked about being like, oh gosh, I don't want to be blacklisted. And I think if we're going to have this kind of professional discourse, we need to also recognize that it's important to see all points of view. Like that's what we do. Anyway, go ahead.
Fair enough. So the point I'm taking is that I don't think, and I could be wrong, I don't think a word processing software or a collaborative whiteboard is inherently biased. Now, I could be wrong about that. Someone could tell me, look, the people who program it, the companies behind it are mostly white. And okay, maybe, sure, okay. But I've just never had that like thought to myself, like, oh, am I promoting a collaborative whiteboard that marginalizes people? I've never had that.
Fair.
You know, we're being told by experts in the field that this stuff does amplify bias. And that's where I can say like, hey, I'm not going to be a booster. I'm going to be a critical thinker.
I like that.
Yes.
I see that we're coming to the end of the time we said we'd do together. Creativity. I want to point out, you know, when we started, before we started recording, we talked about, you know, and you mentioned it here, taking money from artists and taking their work. And I just want to say for me, like people know I'm a sketchnoter. I recently illustrated a book and I make some money off that. Like, you know, it's part of it. Like it's a little side gig for myself. And I do it not as much for, you know, the few $100 I might get for it, but just I love what it does to my mental health. I love the act of creating. I love sitting and thinking about, okay, how would I draw this? And can I try this new font? And what about this new tool? I love that. And I would hate to see that go with a true adoption dive into the deep end of all things AI. Because I think that we're going to see a mental health crisis in if we don't already have one, if we really stop creating and truly creating and that act of getting messy. And every time I go to sketchnote, I'm extremely stressed when I start because I'm like, oh, because I have perfection paralysis and that. But I think working through those emotions, I think there's something to be said for that. You know, do you agree?
I think it's true that the big companies, the big content providers are truly going to go to AI generated content. Then what's going to happen is the things that are created by human beings are going to be so valuable and so sought after. I mean, I don't want to live in a world where anyone with like, if you have just only people with disposable income and sign up for Substack mm-hmm. to get actual human generated content, that sounds like a nightmare to me.
Me too.
But I do think that if this is action that companies are going to try to go, us as human beings are going to say, I want human generated content because that's the, I'm sorry. I don't see a video being made by AI that's going to entertain me. It just won't. I need this. By the way, did you watch any of the late night shows or see any of the comedians during the writer strike? I'll tell you, I'm sorry to throw shade. I saw Jon Stewart do stand up during the writer strike, and he was bad. And I just saw his first episode back on The Daily Show, and he had writers, and he was fantastic. So that's, yeah. So, yeah.
But I think that speaks to a lot. That's the human brain. That's the human heart. That's collaboration. That's community. There's so much that you don't get sitting and just talking to a computer. I hope that people have had a moment here. We always say, if you have an aha, give it a go. And my give it a go is sort of the antithesis of what it normally is. Normally I'd be like, oh, cool tool. I'm going to jump in and try it. Now I think, cool tool, I'm going to pause and think before I play the way I have been. And I appreciate that the dissonance that you've given me with it, with tools that I've been really like shallow end playing in, but maybe second guessing even if I want to be there. And sometimes I will, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to use some tools, but I think having that moment of pause is important. Like you said, when we have bias, when I know, oh, should I present this point of view to my students? Is this the person I want to, or is this what I want to talk about in my class? What voices are being marginalized? What voices are being oppressed? What I'm seeing that now in me thinking about and reading about, and I'm hoping with this, my phone's been listening and my Twitter feed and algorithm is going to change a little bit. And maybe I'll start seeing some more of that to be more critical, because I think that's really important. I
appreciate your willingness and openness to, you know, having a little conversation that might be a little different than what's been out there. So that's awesome, Jen.
So people are going to want to follow you, I'm sure, if they don't already on Twitter. They're going to want to find this blog post. Where can they find you?
So Tom E. Mullaney with two L's on Twitter.
And of course at TomMullaney.com. I will link to that in the show notes. You can find at ShooksAndGif.com. I really encourage you all to read Tom's blog post. I have seen it and it is a really great read with some really, really great resources to give you some pause and thought. Tom, thank you so much. Listeners, if you had an aha here, I hope it might be someone like my aha. Go ahead and give it a go. Until next time. That's it for this episode of Shooks and Gif. The show notes for this episode and all episodes can be found at www.shooksandgif.com. That's ShuksAndGiff. And I'd love to hear about your ahas. Please reach out, DM me on social media. I can be found at VirtualGif. That's with two Fs. So until next time, if you have an aha, give it a go.